From Pacifica Station, KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, November 10, 2008. U.S. lawmakers urge more help for the auto industry while the Treasury hands out more money to banks. Massive protests continue nearly 1 week after California voters decide to amend the state constitution and strip same-sex partners of their right to marry. And Miriam Makeba dies at the age of 76. I'm Aura Bogado. Stay tuned for that and more after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Two veterans' rights groups announced today that they've filed a lawsuit against the Department of Veterans Affairs. Vietnam Veterans of America and Veterans of Modern Warfare seek an end to what they call unconscionable delays in decisions on disability benefit claims. Donald Overton is the executive director of Veterans of Modern Warfare. He explains why quick access to benefits is so important.
A primary concern for us would be compensation in and of itself to provide financial relief for these veterans as they return home with the devastating after effects of combat. It's very difficult for them to transition back into society to reintegrate, and so it's often difficult for them to find employment. It takes time for them to get stability back in their lives, so looking for the ability to help guide them through this process.
The VA acknowledges it takes at least 6 months to reach an initial decision. Overton says the delay is closer to a year. Appeals, on average, drag on for more than 4 years. The lawsuit calls for initial decisions in 90 days and appeals within 180 days. The two groups filed the matter on behalf of veterans because, under federal law, individual veterans cannot seek remedy through the courts. In Zimbabwe, opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai says the MDC will not share power in an inclusive government. Davison Makanga has the story.
Rival parties are still deadlocked following a regional summit last weekend. The Southern Africa Development Community, or SADC, pushed for the formation of an inclusive government effective immediately. President Robert Mugabe responded swiftly, saying, "You appoint cabinet ministers in the next few days." However, the Movement for Democratic Change, led by Morgan Tsvangirai, says it will not be part of the government. The opposition says a number of crucial issues were overlooked at the expense of the police-controlling Home Affairs Ministry. The regional board decreed that both ZANPF and MDC should co-manage the controversial ministry, but the opposition is not happy with the idea. Spokesperson George Swachiwa says his party will not make any further concessions.
As MDC, we will have nothing to do with that government. If Mugabe wants to go ahead and form a government with Atom Tambara, he can go ahead.
The pressure is now on Mugabe to convince his rival to join a unit government or risk isolation. The SADC summit said it would not support any government unless it constitutes all three parties. The MDC is now considering seeking remedy from the African Union. But insiders in Mugabe's camp say the 84-year-old leader, accused of gross human rights violation, might be running out of patience. For FSRIN, this is Davison Makanga in Cape Town, South Africa.
Nearly a week after the election, votes are fully tallied and Colorado has become the first state in the nation to defeat an anti-affirmative action constitutional amendment. Blake Welsey is in Denver and has the story.
California millionaire Ward Connerly spearheaded Amendment 46 in an effort to eliminate statewide affirmative action programs in state contracting and public education and employment. Connerly argues affirmative action discriminates by giving preferential treatment based on race and gender.
At some point, I think we're going to have to decide whether we want our government using race for or against one group of people over another.
Connerly has been successful in pushing similar measures in California, Washington, Michigan, and now Nebraska, where the amendment passed last week with 59% of the vote. But in Colorado, voters have narrowly rejected the controversial anti-affirmative action measure by just 1% of the vote, marching too close to call in the aftermath of the election. Strong opposition to the amendment resulted in a heated battle over equal opportunity measures for women and minorities. Colorado Reverend Patrick Dimmer was one community leader who spoke out against it.
Affirmative action simply demands that positive steps will be taken to provide equal employment and opportunity for everybody. It is not quotas, it is fairness. It is not privilege, it's principles. It is not discrimination, it is decency.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Blake Wesley in Denver.
Chile's new health minister announced over the weekend that the country's main HIV/AIDS testing center and blood bank failed to notify dozens of people that they carry the virus. From Santiago, Free Speech Radio News' Jorge Garretón has more.
The new health minister has announced a major crackdown on Chile's National AIDS Commission. The move follows the revelation this weekend that Santiago's main HIV center and blood bank failed to notify people who came for HIV screening that they tested positive. Center officials said there were only 5 unreported cases. They also tried to ease fears of tainted blood in Chile's main blood bank, where testing of the blood supply is currently underway. However, this is not the first time positive HIV results have been withheld from patients. Last month in the northern city of Iquique, the health ministry admitted that at least 5 people with HIV/AIDS were not notified of their status for at least 5 years. 3 people reportedly died because their illness went untreated. This despite the fact in Chile, HIV/AIDS treatment is free. The Iquique case forced the resignation of the health minister. The new health minister says a complete restructuring to the National AIDS Commission is in the works. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
Brothers M. Rosi and Ali Nurhasim and Imam Samudra, the 3 men known as the Bali Bombers, were executed by firing squad shortly after midnight on Sunday on a prison island off southern Java. Thousands of mourners attended their funerals in East Java. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
China announced Sunday a nearly $600 billion economic stimulus, the largest effort of its kind in China to date. Chinese President Hu Jintao is set to meet with President Bush later this week in Washington. He spoke to President-elect Obama by phone Saturday. Back in the U.S., the Treasury Department has eliminated an obscure tax provision code without approval from Congress, which could provide a massive windfall for big banks. The Treasury also announced that insurance giant AIG's rescue will now cost taxpayers $150 billion. Meanwhile, Obama and his staff are talking very seriously about an auto industry bailout. FSRN's Tanya Snyder has the details.
Over the weekend, Democratic leaders urged Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson to give a boost to the auto industry with funds from the $700 billion bailout. While the Bush administration is shunning the appeal, on Friday, President-elect Obama said the auto industry needs help now. Congress has already approved $25 billion in aid for the auto industry, but it's been caught up in red tape. General Motors recently announced quarterly losses of $39 billion, the second largest quarterly drop in corporate history.
The auto industry's reach is well beyond just manufacturing of cars itself. The manufacturing relies on a lot of suppliers and a large retail network of dealers, and all those organizations would be threatened by collapse of any one of the big 3 auto firms.
Robertson Williams is a budget specialist at the Urban Institute. He says the auto industry is suffering because potential car buyers can't get access to credit to buy cars. But he warns that the bailout pie only has so many pieces.
The $700 billion initially was to go entirely to the financial sector. Then $300 billion is carved off to deal with mortgages directly. And they're now talking about carving $50 billion, at least $25 billion out for the auto industry. The pie is not infinitely elastic. You can't keep cutting more and more pieces out of it without having to shrink the size of the pieces you've already tried to cut.
Let that be a word of warning as the Treasury Department announces the giveaway of another $40 billion piece of bailout pie, this time for AIG, the insurance giant that was bailed out even before the bailout was passed. Many financial experts have said the government's quick fix wasn't well thought out and that it would have been better just to let AIG declare bankruptcy. AIG lost almost $25 billion in the last quarter. A few weeks ago, AIG's CEO Edward Liddy told the NewsHour that they might need more money, depending on what happened in the capital markets.
To the extent they continue to go down and we have to keep posting collateral, it's possible it may not be enough.
The government's planned purchase of $40 billion of preference shares gives the government an ownership stake in the company. This brings the total to a record $150 billion of government money for AIG. But direct bailouts aren't the only gift Treasury has for Wall Street. While Congress was wringing its hands last month over whether or not to approve the bailout, Treasury quietly made a change to tax policy that could save big business up to $140 billion. Not only did the department sidestep congressional approval for this move, they didn't notify lawmakers about the policy change. The Washington Post broke the story Monday.
Section 382 is a provision of the Internal Revenue Code that was enacted over 20 years ago and was intended to prevent trafficking in companies with net operating losses.
Stu Finkelstein is a tax partner at the law firm Skadden Arps in New York. He says that companies sometimes buy up troubled businesses to show net losses. Consequently, they pay less money in taxes. So these unprofitable companies become very profitable to their buyers. He uses Wachovia as an example of a company that had a large portfolio of loans that had declined in value. Those loans hadn't been repaid, so they hadn't taken the loss yet, but it was coming. That's a built-in loss. And Treasury's elimination of Section 382 allowed Wells Fargo to take on those built-in losses as their own.
It would allow Wachovia to recognize those losses after the acquisition and use those losses to offset Wachovia's income going forward.
Members of Congress are considering legislation to undo the change. No one is willing to say the change was illegal, though many tax experts agree that Treasury didn't have the authority to essentially repeal a law that Congress passed in order to prevent companies from avoiding paying taxes. For FSRN, I'm Tanya Snyder in Washington.
Obama campaigned on the need for change, and toward the top of that list for the human rights community is shutting down Guantanamo Bay and putting an end to U.S.-sponsored torture. Experts say that after being sworn in on January 20, Obama can do a lot to end torture in his first hours on the job, but how to appropriately close down Guantanamo and transfer the roughly 250 remaining prisoners into some other system of justice is an incredibly complex task. FSRN's Eric Klein has more on how President Obama might go about closing down President Bush's notorious Gitmo.
Human Rights First, based in New York, has been working to accomplish two things. First, to end torture and official cruelty in the United States, and second, the closing of Guantanamo. Michael Posner is president of Human Rights First. He met with the candidate Barack Obama during the primaries, in meetings organized with more than a dozen retired admirals and generals, to talk about the issue of torture and how the next administration should deal with it.
The meeting with Senator Obama was very encouraging, and at the same time, I think it was for him a good, you know, opportunity just to ask questions and to learn. And as I say, he was very attentive. He took copious notes. He was very instantly sympathetic to what we were trying to do, but really wanted to kind of draw out these military veterans about what the negative effects of coercion are and to get a better sense for his own background and knowledge just of how this has affected the military and national security.
Human Rights First is advocating for President-elect Obama to renounce torture and official cruelty in his inaugural address. Their blueprint for ending torture in the first 100 days is online at humanrightsfirst.org and includes recommendations to enforce existing torture bans by dismantling the legal framework sanctioning torture created under the Bush years and closing secret prisons to end the practice of holding ghost prisoners. Human Rights First also has a blueprint for closing Gitmo. Barack Obama has said that he intends to close Guantanamo, but how he would go about it is an open question. Michael Posner would like to see the Obama administration bring the Gitmo detainees out of the Bush administration's legal framework and into the U.S. court system.
I think it would send an enormously strong and positive signal to the world if in some of the most notorious cases, like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, we assembled the evidence and prosecuted those individuals as criminals in an open court in the United States and used our legal system to ensure both justice and accountability.
But even while human rights advocates like Michael Posner are calling for all of the detainees to be either tried in U.S. courts or let go, there is talk of setting up a new court system to deal with the Gitmo prisoners. David Kay is the executive director of the International Human Rights Program at UCLA School of Law and former lawyer with the U.S. State Department. He says there have been proposals to set up a brand new terrorism court to try Gitmo detainees, although he'd personally prefer that the U.S. court system was used. But before any kind of trial, he says, the Obama administration would have to gather a lot of information.
The first thing is identify the prisoners who are being held at Guantanamo Bay. And so there's going to have to be some kind of categorization and understanding because You know, of course, the Pentagon has not been totally open about who it's holding and why it's holding them. So the administration is simply going to have to get a handle on who's being held there.
Case says that there's a possibility that many being held at Guantanamo could be tried in U.S. courts, that others should be repatriated without trial to their home countries, either to be tried there or set free, and that another group should be released into the U.S. since they could face torture and persecution if sent home. That last group includes the Uyghurs, also known as the Chinese Muslims. Michael Ratner is president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He says that any trial of detainees would be complicated by the fact that many have been tortured. He calls it a serious problem.
Well, certainly part of the trial will be how these defendants were treated, how they were coerced, how basically nothing that was said about them, certainly by other people who were coerced and tortured, is going to be reliable.
The Center for Constitutional Rights represented hundreds of Gitmo detainees and has been working on some of their cases since the Bush administration's so-called War on Terror began. As for the transfer of power to an Obama administration,
what he should do on the first day he takes office, he should announce that he's closing Guantanamo, and he should present a plan for doing so very quickly. The high majority of people, 200 out of the 255 left, maybe more, can be returned almost immediately to their home countries.
At this date, the future of Guantanamo Bay detainees is a subject of enormous amounts of speculation, with very little information coming out of the Obama camp on record. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Eric Klein.
Protests are sweeping across California in defiance of Proposition 8, the amendment that changed the state's constitution to define marriage as solely between a man and a woman. Marches and rallies have closed entire streets down in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Oakland for nearly a week. Activists have also targeted churches whose members helped sponsor the same-sex marriage ban and have called for a boycott of Utah. Africa Jones reports.
Thousands have taken to the streets since the passage of Proposition 8, which banned same-sex marriage.
We're not going to take this decision sitting down, and we're not going to let people take away our rights.
Brian Carrion helped organize a protest in San Francisco, which drew thousands of people and shut down the city's main street for hours on Friday.
Historically, the Constitution has protected the rights of minority groups from the whims of the majority, and that's something that should have happened here and didn't. And instead, the people, by a simple majority vote, tried to take away a fundamental right from us, and we think that that is wrong, and historically, we think that we're on the right side of things.
Activists are targeting churches which they say contributed to the passage of the ban. The Catholic Church allied with evangelicals and Mormons to pass the gay marriage ban, and millions of dollars poured in from Utah in support of Prop 8, much of it from members of the Mormon Church, according to the San Francisco Chronicle. In addition to protests, some are calling for a boycott of Utah, home of the Sundance Film Festival, a growing tourism industry, and where many Mormon institutions are headquartered. Roscoe Gonzalez is an artist and activist that joined the San Francisco March.
We can't keep on supporting churches that work against us. We need to go to those churches and make our presence known and be sitting in those pews and let those people get to know our relationships.
Some media outlets have been blaming the passage of Prop 8 on African Americans, who overwhelmingly supported the proposition, but black people comprise less than 7% of the state's population. Nevertheless, there have been tensions.
Man and a woman is marriage. They're trying to take the word, change it.
One man calling himself Mr. Killens wore priestly garb and stood in the middle of the San Francisco rally holding a Yes on 8 sign. Protesters took turns arguing with him.
My brother, you black, we've been through this before. It's the same thing. My parents could not get married in the 50s when they were together. No, it's not.
Someone's trying to say marriage is no longer between a man and a woman. We're adding to that, not taking away.
Activists say they will continue to fight. Poyo Del Mar, a well-known drag queen, energized people with a speech at the San Francisco rally.
40 years ago, you and I couldn't have used the same restroom, or we couldn't have used the same water fountain. Barack Obama would have never been in office, certainly. And people's beliefs change, and times change, and the laws have to change to reflect those.
Civil rights activists, along with the cities of San Francisco and Los Angeles and the county of Santa Clara, have filed suit with the state's Supreme Court to block enforcement of Proposition 8. And this coming Saturday is a national day of action with protests planned in many cities across the country. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Africa Jones.
You're listening to FSRN. Join us tomorrow when we present a special on Winter Soldier, testimonies from Iraq and Afghanistan veterans.
You know, I would go down there like
scream at detainees, like throw chairs, knock over tables, like have Iraqis laying on the ground where I'm screaming at them, you know, while they're in tears crying.
The vets are currently touring the country, telling their stories of the reality of war. Voices include veterans Camilo Mejia, Hanan Suarez Diaz, Jan Critchfield, David Mann, and Iraqi Ahmed Abed, whose two-year-old son lost his leg in a U.S. missile strike on Fallujah. That's tomorrow on FSRN Veterans Day for Winter Soldier Eyewitness Accounts of the War. Outgoing Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has made her last trip to the Middle East, stating that Palestinian-Israeli negotiations are vibrant and vital and will lead to a Palestinian state. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has reiterated his commitment to the Roadmap Peace Plan, a plan that Gaza's Hamas party opposes. As FSRN's Rami Almagari reports, rivalry between Abbas's Fatah party and the Hamas party continues to overshadow public life in the occupied territories.
Since August, more than 4,000 out of 16,000 school teachers and staff in Gaza have been striking against what the Fatah-linked teachers' union describes as unwanted transfers and appointments in the Hamas-run territory. Jamil Shahada is the Secretary General of Palestinian Teachers' Union.
They have replaced non-Hamas teachers with teachers from Hamas or its supporters, and they have also excessively transferred and excluded hundreds of other teachers and school principals.
But the Hamas-run education ministry claims its new regulations and installations are typical administrative measures within the ministry's authority in Gaza. Mohammed Askoul is the Minister of Education in Gaza.
If we want to evaluate the strike from a professional standpoint, most of their demands don't relate to the rights of the educational sector workers. I say there aren't any problems. There hasn't been excessive firing or transfers of those working in the educational sector.
The ruling Hamas party argues that the teachers' strike was initiated just to create some kind of instability in the strip as a part of a previous calls by the Ramallah-based government to boycott Hamas following the party's takeover of Gaza in June 2007. However, the Ramallah-based Fatah loyal government says it has nothing to do with such a strike and continues to pay the salaries of Gaza-based teachers, denying reports that those not complying with the strike are no longer paid. At the Ahmad Shawqi Secondary School for Girls in Gaza City, where most of the striking teachers were replaced with the newly recruited ones, a working day goes on smoothly. Shayma Ziyara is a 10th level student at the school.
It's a good kind of, but they brought many good teachers for us and to close the empty places in the school, and they teach us in a very good way. Some of them doesn't have the enough experience for us, but most of them are good, and it's almost good.
In addition to the education sector strike in Gaza, the health sector has also seen strikes over the past 4 months. More than 45,000 other government employees have been sitting idle since the President Mahmoud Abbas of Fatah has ordered a boycott of Hamas in June of last year. This week, the rival Fatah and Hamas parties were expected to meet in Cairo to discuss ending the current Palestinian division and developing a national unity government. But Cairo called off the conference upon Hamas' request. Hamas had insisted that any talks with Fatah could not proceed unless the Abbas-led Palestinian Authority stopped arrests of its members and supporters in the West Bank. Abbas denied any such arrests. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Rami Almighari in Gaza.
And it is with deep sorrow that we announce that Mama Africa has taken her last bow. Miriam Makeba died from a heart attack after performing on stage Sunday night in southern Italy. Makeba was born in Johannesburg and raised in Pretoria, but her songs about life under apartheid barred her from returning to South Africa for 30 years, including through the death of her mother. During that time, she traveled the world and endured 5 marriages, including one to Black Panther leader Stokely Carmichael, even fleeing with him to Guinea. Miriam Makeba finally returned home to South Africa in 1990 after Nelson Mandela was released from prison and personally asked her to come back. Makeba performed around the world until the day she died. Sunday night, she collapsed on stage after a performance honoring 6 African immigrants who were killed in a suspected mafia shooting and in support of an Italian writer who also faced threats from the mafia. Miriam Makeba performed during a fundraiser in 1968 for my home station, KPFK, here in LA's Coconut Grove at the Ambassador Hotel. Little did anyone know then that Robert Kennedy would be shot and killed there just 3 months later. In this clip, Makeba is introduced by Lena Horne and begins her set after a brief fund drive pitch from an announcer.
The nicest duty I have to perform all day today here at KPFK is to introduce Miriam Makeba, a gracious lady, a magnificent talent, an electrifying personality. Live from my home, away from home, the Coconut Grove, the marvelous Miriam Makeba.
And thank you, Lena. I'm Roger Lang, sitting ringside at the fabulous Coconut Grove and the Ambassador Hotel in downtown Los Angeles. In just a few minutes, the marvelous Miriam Makeba will be on stage. So quickly, before she goes on, dash to your telephone and subscribe to KPFK. Or make a contribution. You can earmark your contribution to KPFK for a series of live remote broadcasts just like this one if you'd like to. Here's Miriam Makeba.
Hey, thank you so much, ladies and gentlemen. This song is a South African song, like most of our songs, and it comes from Pondoland in the Eastern Cape, where my father came from. In the olden days, the young Xhosa maidens often sang this song in praise of the young Xhosa braves, as they would get ready to go out into battle. Song of encouragement. We call it Cholingo. Cholingo.
Miriam Makeba performing at the Coconut Grove 40 years ago in audio preserved by the Pacifica Radio Archives. Makeba died late Sunday night in Italy. She was 76. That will do it for our newscast. You've been listening to FSRN from Pacifica Station, KPFK in Los Angeles. I'm Aura Bogado. I'm